It's Saturday and time for the Chan Hasty Show on News Talk 790 KFYO. A not so serious show about pop culture, entertainment, sports, stupid criminals, and stories that make you laugh. Call in now, 770-5790, or NTS toll-free at 1-800-687-0790. The Chan Hasty Show on the news and talk of West Texas. News Talk 790, KFYO.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's Matt Crow. I'm filling in for Chad Hasty here on News Talk 790 KFYO. And I know the bumper says we're going to talk about some unserious things, but first up, we're going to talk about a few serious things, one of which is in the last couple of weeks, the United Nations has issued several reports on the United States' use of drones in our global war on terror. And I thought it was, you know, interesting reports from the UN criticizing the United States for our activities overseas as far as going after terrorists. Not that we have to worry about what the United Nations think, but, you know, after all, we are a member of the UN. We need to play together with well with other countries. And so I thought it'd be interesting to have an expert on counterinsurgency warfare on the radio show this afternoon. And we're lucky enough to have Dr. Caleb Sepp, who is out in Monterey, California. He teaches at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. He was a deputy assistant secretary in Bush 43 in the Bush White House, over the DOD across the river from the White House. And Dr. Sepp is one of these people who really knows what he's talking about. And thank God we had people like this in the government, in the Bush administration, and in the war on terror. Because if we hadn't, we might be in a totally different place today. And Dr. Sepp was a former Army officer. He was in the Special Forces. I'm just going to touch on some of the highlights because he does sound like something out of a movie. And I hope he forgives me for saying that, and I say that with admiration. Member of the 82nd Airborne, 2nd Ranger Battalion, 11th Armored Cavalry, in the 24th Infantry, and on top of that, as I said, an expert on counterinsurgency, advised the Secretary of Defense. He also worked on the Iraq Study Group, and many of you might remember that was the Baker-Hamilton Group that was assigned by the President and the Congress to look at the causes and effects and what the future of the United States should be after we went to war with Iraq and beat Iraq in that war. The Congress asked, and I think it was Congressman Wolf, was kind of the impetus for that. But anyway, Dr. Sepp was one of the experts that Jim Baker and Lee Hamilton turned to see what, you know, what is our future in Iraq. He has also been an instructor at West Point, which I think speaks for itself. And Dr. Sepp is with us today from Monterey. Good afternoon, Dr. Sepp. How are you?
Hello, Matt. Great to be with you.
I want to give our phone-in number to our listeners, 1-800-687-0790, and also 770-5790 if you'd like to call in with questions for Dr. Sepp. Doctor, what, you know, in the last couple of weeks, it seems to me that there's been more attention given to the use and practice of drone warfare against our enemy, particularly in Pakistan. Now, I don't know if this comes in cycles or not, but I know we've used drones for several years on the battlefield. You probably, I know you saw combat in Central America, in El Salvador. We weren't using drones back then in Central America, were we?
Actually, we were.
We were. Okay.
There was a classified, then classified, drone program that dealt more with what we now call ISR, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, under the code name Gray Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And it was they were flown out of Panama, out of when we still had bases there. Over Salvador to help try and help spot guerrilla troop movements in, during Salvadoran civil war.
So that at least since the mid '80s, then they've been deployed in the battlefield, and then of course with the Desert Storm and Desert Shield, and then the Iraq War and the global war on terror after 9/11, we've used them quite a bit. For the layman, drones seem to be fairly effective. Are they, from the battlefield view, from the battlefield commander's view, are they considered just another tool now in your repertoire of weapons, or are they considered something a little above and beyond than that? What's the view of battlefield commanders when it comes to drone usage?
That's a great question, Matt. You know, over 10 years ago, there were only 50 drones of all kinds in the entire armed forces. Today, there are 7,500 drones that we own and we fly. All the services use them: the Air Force, the Navy, the Army, and Marines. They're in different sizes. From models that are small enough for one soldier or marine to just throw with his arm, as if he were throwing a little balsa wood glider, to launch it, up to the Northrop Grumman's Global Hawk, which is so big, that it can operate at, 50,000 feet above the ground, and has, just a few years ago, just to show its capability, it flew nonstop across the entire Pacific Ocean. So commanders on the battlefield have gotten where, 10 years ago it was very new. Now they expect to use, UAVs in an integrated way, in all of their operations. It's just a normal way of getting in intelligence.
You taught at West Point. I know many of the courses at West Point have to do with ethics and leadership, ethics and warfare. One of the points in the UN report that was published this week talked about collateral damage and how the United States is either not reporting or underreporting civilian deaths in drone strikes. Explain to me how are drones different than saying artillery rounds fired after an enemy in a village where you do have civilians, but you have the terrorists or the enemy hiding amongst the populace? Is there any difference? Is it a case of this is another weapon where we have to be, of course, careful and thoughtful and look before we shoot and so forth? Or are drones susceptible to causing more collateral damage than say artillery rounds?
Matt, you've asked a very prescient question about this, and this is an ongoing debate. And normally I would say we should now get an ethicist or a philosopher who specializes in the ethics of remote killing on the line, and that would probably be Dr. Brad Strasser, who I would commend to you and your readers is just. Edited a new book on the problems and ethics of this kind of warfare. And attendant to it is, and it's great that you make the comparison with artillery. But the idea of drones seems to really focus on the idea that the attacker is completely safe. And only the target is at risk, and there's some ethical concern that somehow this more than it not being fair is that it makes killing too easy because the attacker is completely invulnerable, and then that ties to what you just raised about the point about is the killing precise enough. That innocents aren't killed and wounded in the same attacks intended against a valid combatant.
We're talking to Dr. Caleb Sepp from the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. Our call numbers are 1-800-687-0790 and locally 770-5790. Didn't mean to interrupt you, Dr. Sepp. We're going to be going to a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about what the process is on the battlefield from a kind of a 20,000-foot perspective, pardon the pun, when combat commanders use the drones, what kind of theaters can they operate in, what are the limitations of the drones. One point you touched on just briefly, and we'll come back to it. What you just said about the remote controlled killing aspect of drones reminds me a little bit back in the Vietnam War when they talked about the B-52 missions that were flown over Hanoi and bombing from high altitudes, and that the pilots and the bombardiers and the flight crews were, you know, separated somewhat from the battlefield. And of course, they were. They weren't down in the jungle underneath the jungle canopy. But there was the same knock against that weapon. So I think the parallels are kind of interesting that you raise when we get into situations like that.
I'm glad to talk about it when we get back, but I would point out right now that even then, the anti-aircraft systems that defended North Vietnam, so, you know, supplied and supported and advised by the Red Chinese and the Russians,
mm-hmm.
it was the densest and most effective anti-aircraft system in the entire world. And during those bombing missions, those B-52 missions, it was called part of the Linebacker Operation, mm-hmm. Linebacker 2.
Mm-hmm.
We lost 10% of the entire U.S. B-52 bomber fleet shot down. So those air crews were not, you know, not invulnerable in conducting their missions.
Well, and I think too, you know, you raise an excellent point now, because as I understand it, we can get into this a little bit later after the break. But as I understand it, the controls of the drone systems that I've read about are often away from the battlefield, and in some cases they're not even in the same country. They're around the world, and they're controlled by data link. So we'll talk a little bit more about this, but it's an interesting situation that you may have Air Force personnel or Army personnel or Navy personnel thousands of miles away. So we'll talk about that when we get back. We've got Dr. Caleb Sepp from the Naval Postgraduate School out in Monterey. We'll be back on News Talk 790 KFYO.
Join the discussion right now. Call 770-5790 or star 790 on your AT&T wireless phone. The Chad Hastie Show on the news and talk of West Texas. News Talk 790 KFYO.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Matt Crow in from the KFYO News Desk. I'm filling in for Chad Hastie today. And I've got Ariel Walden producing the show in the control room there, thank goodness, because we're talking about B-52 missions. Ariel would make a great navigator, a great combat navigator. She knows exactly what she's doing. I wanted also to mention that later in the show we're going to be talking to Dr. Don May, who's running for Congress against Rennie Nagebauer in the Republican primary here in Lubbock. In March is when the primary is, in case you didn't know that. And then later on in the show, we're going to talk a little about more politics, only national politics, with Brian Walsh. You might recognize Brian's name. Brian's a frequent contributor to Fox Television and also MSNBC. We'll talk about the upcoming midterm elections and the 16 presidential elections. We're talking to Dr. Caleb Sepp right now, who's a senior lecturer out at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, a combat veteran, former West Point instructor, also a deputy assistant secretary in the Defense Department. Talking about drones, the United Nations came after the United States this week and said that the United States is flagrantly abusing the drones, that there's no accountability, that we're not being honest about collateral damage and so forth. And the question I was asking a little bit earlier about ethics in warfare, and I'm certainly no expert on that. I know what some of the famous generals said about warfare and so forth in the Civil War and how war is prosecuted. But Dr. Sepp, it seems to me that, you know, A pilot who's flying a drone is going to be subject to the same limitations and rules of war and combat engagement rules as an F-16 pilot or an F-35 pilot flying over the battlefield. Is that not correct?
That's exactly right. They're educated and trained to comply with those rules. One of my students here, an Air Force major, had begun her career as a B-52 bomber pilot after she graduated from Notre Dame, and then was transitioned as the drone program, or unmanned, you know, the Air Force prefers mm-hmm. to call it the unmanned aerial vehicle program, mm-hmm. Became more and more expansive, and in the way that you were describing before the break, you know, she pulled, you know, she sat in the simulated cockpit just outside of Las Vegas Nevada.
Mm-hmm. A Creech Air Force Base there, or Nellis,
yeah,
or Creech?
Creech. Yeah. Creech, mm-hmm. Creech is where they are now. That's exactly
mm-hmm.
right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and was piloting vehicles, aerial vehicles, 8,000 miles away, you know, through satellite links.
Mm-hmm.
And then after conducting combat missions, and she had been awarded 11 aerial achievement medals for her conduct of missions, including several of them for classified missions.
Mm-hmm.
And then she would, you know, walk out of her bunker, get in her car, and, you know, go to the Safeway,
right,
pick up dinner.
Yeah.
And but that doesn't, that, you know, there's a particular kind of stress that goes with it, but the target identification process, you'll hear special operations personnel call it the PID, the positive identification
mm-hmm.
system, to make sure that they were hitting the target that they actually, you know, had to, you know, they wanted the individual or the group of enemy combatants that, you know, that they were specifically seeking. They go through that, they check themselves against that constant. The idea is, you know, this is that tension before that you raised in the mm-hmm. ethical point. Isn't it ethical to not expose your own troops to any danger that you don't have to? If you have a technology that allows them, you know, everything from, you know, bulletproof vests to unmanned aerial vehicles, isn't it the most ethical thing that you equip your troops with that and allow them to use these weapons?
Well, it seemed, it would seem to be, and I hope and pray that the day never comes where the United Nations dictates what we do militarily. Can you describe our listeners have sons and daughters in the military, husbands and wives. You're on the ground in a combat situation or an offensive situation, you know, of course, defensive as well, if things go south. How instantaneous is it that the drones can be called in to help? Are they used in that way in a real-time combat situation, or are the drones more... Are they used primarily in kind of strategic, long-range, ahead-of-time type of situations?
Oh, terrific concept question. You know, as I was mentioning earlier in our conversations, some of these drones are actually controlled by, you know, platoons or companies that are operating right on the ground. They'll decide they literally just want to see what's over the next ridgeline,
mm-hmm.
In the next valley, and they'll be able to launch their own drones and get an immediate feedback, you know, through a radio, mm-hmm. a digital radio signal, to get visual imagery. The larger, strategic, pieces that you're talking about is exactly why we pursued drones. Mm-hmm. If I could step back in history very briefly, the arming of drones, you know, first of all, drones have been around since the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
And then went through a series of, you know, further developments in the Second World War. And, you know, your listeners are probably actually familiar with this. I'm sure almost everybody has seen hobbyists flying remote control planes.
Yeah, it is fascinating that the technology has crept down into the AC model world. I mean, I don't know what came first, the chicken or the egg there, but just want to mention real quickly, our lines are open, 800-687-0790, and I do have a caller. And welcome to the Chad Hasty Show. Go ahead.
Yes, Bradford Jackson here. The wonderful thing about the United States is that we do have incredible technology. And the drone program is probably our finest, best, you know, technological achievements, you know, in the fight, in, you know, especially for battling against Muslim extremists, Al Qaeda, whatever, what have you. But historically, you know, Germany fought a technical war because they had incredible technology. They had the Panzer, they had the Me-102, they had U-2s, they had buzz bombs. You know, there were no Patriot missiles or anything to take those out or anything else like that. We basically defeated Germany, not technically, but strategically by sheer numbers. we had a lot of Panzer tanks, Sherman tanks, and which were no match for the German Panzers, you know, of the time, or the German Luger, for crying out loud. The technology, you know, they had even Wanner von Braun, for crying out loud, that actually developed the U-2. I mean, highly technical, but strategically, we just carpet bombed them into submission. You know?
So your point being that the strategy and tactics will overcome technology. Dr. Sepp, what do you think about that?
I'll tell you, Mr. Jackson certainly knows his history. You can come lecture in my classroom anytime.
I'd love to.
But he makes a very, very good point that there is a level at which, despite he draws on the World War II German example, where the Germans often had these very, very advanced technologies and well in advance of what we had, but we still prevailed.
Sure.
You know, for a number of reasons, not the least of which, you know, that our cause was just. Just because we have these technologies now does not assure that we will be successful in military campaigns in the future.
My point is technological wars are extremely expensive. You know, Hitler was grinding out Marx just to stay alive, just to keep things moving forward. And I see the United States in the sense that, you know, we have all this incredible technology, but again, it's extremely expensive. And yes, we can be the policeman to the world and surgically take out, you know, certain factions. But even as you can understand that, you actually had a drone that belly flopped in Iran, and they put that sucker on display, and they're going to scratch and sniff that thing and reverse engineer it and send it right back to us. And they are developing nuclear weapons. And it takes is a strategic, you know, initiative on the part of Iran and not a tactical one to deliver a nuclear weapon. And that's exactly what brought Japan to its knees. We strategically put one in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. We had, you know, that upper hand. But it's not going to take long before, you know, that nuclear weapons scare the hell out of everyone, even if it's a dirty one.
Bradford, that's a great point. I thanks for your call. You know, Dr. Sepp, as far as the limitations of technology, but you know, he raises a good point. It can only take us so far and so successful on the battlefield and against our enemies. What about proliferation, as he mentioned? I mean, should we be concerned that that our enemies, the terrorists, I mean, they seem to be capable of just about anything. And I think if one thing proves us right, we've underestimated them for the past 10 or 15 years. They are crafty. They are insidious. They are evil. And they're smart buggers too. Should we be worried about them getting their hands on these types of systems, or is that beyond their reach right now?
What I'm going to tell you now, Matt, is all open source, so I'm not revealing anything that's classified. But in the way that I was mentioning remote control model airplanes before, some of those are very, very large and can carry considerable payload. And it is not beyond the capability of terrorists to purchase and construct those, on their own. You don't have to be an aeronautical engineer to do that. You know, hobbyists do this all the time, and put some sort of a payload and an explosive or, you know, some other sort of terror weapon on it and employ it in that way. And that's the same kind of issue that we have. With all of these other lone wolf terrorist operators, and you know, and the different ways that they can attack,
we're gonna
to watch for.
Well, I appreciate your thoughts on that, and of course, you've been out there in the field, and of course, you've got our leaders, our military leaders and officers out at the postgraduate school. And in the short amount of time we've got left, how many students are out at the postgraduate school in Monterey?
Oh, in the entire school, there's about 1,200. It's it's both a combination of a science and technology school teaching computer science, electrical engineering, physics, mathematics to officers, in their educational development. But there's also a side that trains foreign area officers who are going to go overseas and become defense attachés and embassies around the world. And in my department, defense analysis. We educate principally special operations officers, Green Beret, Navy SEAL officers, and even warrant officers and sergeants, and a number of our allies officers as well, in how to think about these very, very difficult problems and bring quantitative and qualitative measures, historical analysis, logic to bear to try and solve.
Boy, are we lucky to have an organization and a structure like that out in California. I would imagine you've seen the best and brightest that we have to offer, and I think speak on behalf of our listeners when I say when you talk to your students and the officers and enlisted personnel out there at school, thank them for us, because not only are they among the elite, but they've chosen to put their lives in harm's way for us and for our families and our children, and we can't thank them enough. And of course for your service as well. One other question I wanted to ask you very quickly. Last question on drones. Should the taxpayers be worried about how they're used by our military? I mean, is this something that we need to worry about? I mean, it seems to me with the United Nations, it just becomes kind of a dull roar after a while. I've looked into this. I have not seen anything that makes me pause that we're committing any kind of war crimes or transgressions or killing indiscriminately with these weapons.
I am not deeply concerned about that, because I am aware of the quality of people that deal with this every day. Just like I mentioned the superb officer who was a drone pilot, came up in the way that everybody recognized. Grew up on a farm in the Midwest. Went to college. Not a military college. Went to a college like most Americans go to, and they come into, they bring that kind of, that ethic, what is right and what is wrong with them. And then it's very focused in terms of how that applies to the battlefield as part of their education and their operations. That the military would misuse them, that things go wrong, that's its own issue.
Yeah.
But a deliberate maluse and lack of control, I'm not concerned because there is so much supervision of
right.
it, and so much concern that it be well managed.
And it seems to me too, just in the scenario you just laid out, where you have several officers with commanders standing behind them, or in a command and control center, where they're flying the drones and where the data is being downlinked and they're looking at real live pictures and so forth, it seems to me that there would be far more oversight and control versus a fighter pilot or a bomber pilot who's off there practically on his own and with little or no supervision directly anyway. I mean,
you are exactly correct. This is one of the strongest arguments for use of drones, which is exactly right. The fighter pilot, he's watching how much fuel he's got left. He's thinking about, can he get this bomb load out? Might he be shot down? He sees something that might be a target. Should he attack? Should he not? He has moments to make a decision, and it might be the wrong one. Whereas back in that bunker at Creech Air Force Base, there are several people looking at the screen. There's time because the drones move slower. They have longer to look at a target. They have other sources they can consult to make sure they're doing the right thing, because they can take the time to analyze and slow down. And that once again becomes that enters into that debate about what is the more ethical you know, type of weapon, the manned fighter or the unmanned drone.
Well, Dr. Sepp, go ahead.
I was going to close it. You know, the idea about accepting civilian casualties. I would just Mr. Jackson's historical insights. Reminded me of this during the Second World War, just before the Normandy invasion, the D-Day invasion. There was part of the preparation was going to be a mass aerial campaign to destroy the French railway system, so the Germans could move their forces on it. And but in the analysis to do that, they determined that they would kill at least 6,000 French civilians
mm-hmm.
doing that. And they went to De Gaulle, Charles De Gaulle, who was the leader of the Free French government in Britain, and presented this to him, essentially as, what do you think of this? And his reply was, this is the price of liberation.
Mm-hmm.
So that we have had to contend with this question of killing of innocents to accomplish military objectives through our history is has many precedents.
It's a hard fact, and unfortunately, though, it's the real world. And Dr. Sepp, you're terrific to come on the show with us today. Best of luck to you and your students out in Monterey at the postgraduate school there. Again, thanks for being on the show. You're listening to the Saturday edition of the Chad Hastie Show here on News Talk 790 KFYO.